This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories. President Raisi says Iran's maximum resistance has foiled Washington's maximum pressure, as evidenced by the U.S. officials' acknowledgement of the campaign's failure. The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says the U.S. and Israel are the real enemies of Muslims, exploiting the Islamic nation's problems for their own purposes. Also in the headlines, the Gaza Strip witnessing a sharp increase in COVID infections. Just ahead, we will bring you a live report from the besieged enclave. Welcome to the program. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says Washington's policy of maximum pressure has failed to achieve its goals.
When the Americans openly acknowledge that they have failed in their maximum pressure policy, an ignominious failure, this is a victory for the Iranian nation.
Raisi said that Iran's policy of maximum resistance has offset the U.S. pressure. Raisi made the remarks during a visit to the mausoleum of the late founder of Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, on the occasion of the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. Back in 2018, former President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from the 2015 deal between Iran and the world powers and intensified a campaign of sanctions to force Tehran to negotiate a new agreement. Iran is marking the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The event is marked every year with a 10-day celebration period known as the 10-day Dawn. Our correspondent Youssef Jalali was present at this year's ceremonies and filed this report.
43 years ago this day, millions of Iranians flocked to Tehran's Mehrabad airport to welcome the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, back to the country after 14 years of exile. The historic day was a milestone that put an end to centuries of monarchy in Iran. Ever since, Iranians have celebrated the occasion every year for 10 days. The event starts on the anniversary of Imam Khomeini's homecoming and culminates on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This period is called Dehe-i Fajr, or the 10-day dawn. As with every year, the ceremonies began with a visit by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to Imam Khomeini's mausoleum. The mausoleum also hosted state officials and people from all walks of life. to mark the occasion.
Like every year, we gather today in this holy place to pay respect to Imam Khomeini, a man who changed the course of history in our country and established a political system that respects our beliefs as Muslims.
Today is an important day for us. We, the new generation, were not present those days, but we participate in this ceremony to learn about the personality of Imam Khomeini.
The Islamic Revolution was led by Imam Khomeini, who spent some 14 years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement, which ultimately led to the toppling of former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S.
During the Shah period, other countries like the U.S. made decisions for us. Iran was a U.S. colony. They were in our country to plunder our oil and other resources.
We lost many of our beloved ones for the sake of the Islamic Republic. By celebrating the event, we seek to say no to foreign interference in our country. We still stick to those ideals no matter how much pressure and sanctions the U.S. imposes on our nation.
Less than 2 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iranians took part in a referendum where more than 98% of eligible voters voted yes to the Islamic Republic as a new political system.
To Iranians, the 10-day dawn is reminiscent of their struggle for independence, a legacy that they're not willing to give up on, even if it means they have to endure U.S. sanctions. Now, one of the major goals of holding such massive celebrations is to pass on these messages to new generations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says the U.S. and Israel are the real enemies of Muslims exploiting divisions among the Muslim Ummah to achieve their goals. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the policy of the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia on Yemen is in line with Israeli stances, evidenced by a recent trip by Israel's president to the UAE. He noted that Saudi Arabia allowed a plane carrying the Israeli delegation to fly over the kingdom, while it prevents Yemeni people from using their own airspace. He said Israel and its loyalists consider Yemeni people as their common enemy. Houthi slammed the Saudi-led coalition's recent airstrike on a prison in northern Yemen as a deliberate attempt to create a massacre. He said the coalition bombed the prison while the United Nations and other international bodies were aware of the location of the facility. Sana'a renews its warning to the United Arab Emirates to end its aggression against Yemeni people. In a tweet, Army spokesman Yahya Sari noted that the safety of the expo being held in Dubai depends on the UAE's conduct. Sari had earlier warned that the UAE will come under continued strikes as long as it targets Yemeni people. On Monday, the Yemeni army launched a third operation against the United Arab Emirates, hitting significant targets including sensitive facilities in the capital, Abu Dhabi. The UAE is a part of the Saudi-led coalition that has been waging a war on Yemen since March of 2015. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed in the onslaught. To our third headline story, and COVID has complicated the humanitarian situation in Gaza that is already reeling from years of Israeli blockade. This has made Gaza's population more prone to outbreaks of the pandemic and increased the strain on the healthcare system there. We're now crossing over to Gaza itself to talk to our man Ashraf Shannon about how grim the situation is. Ashraf.
Hi Arash, the situation in Gaza is extremely grim according to health officials. Yesterday, the director of Shifa Hospital said that he expects that there is at least one case in every house in the Gaza Strip as the Israeli blockade continues to take its toll on the enclave. A few days ago, the Minister of Health announced that Israel has been preventing the entry of testing equipment and testing kits, as well as surgical or hospital equipment into the Gaza Strip, further increasing the risk of coronavirus infections into the enclave. Over the last few days, almost 2,500 cases have been reported discovered in the Gaza Strip on a daily basis. In 2 days, you have 5,000 infections. Yesterday, 8 people died because of COVID-19 complications. Almost 10 cases daily are facing death. Since the start of the pandemic, nearly 1,800 Gazans have died because of this lethal virus. The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has complicated all aspects of life in Gaza, especially in the health sector. At least 1,100 people have died directly because of the Israeli blockade. And also, Gaza suffers from shortages in medicines and hospital supplies. And also, the Israeli regime refuses or places tight restrictions on the exit permits to chronic patients who seek treatment in the occupied West Bank or in Al-Quds, Arash.
Okay, Ashraf, you just mentioned that according to reports, at least each family has one person with COVID-19 right now in the Gaza Strip. I just wonder if there is anyone around you or, you know, in your immediate family or your extended family that is suffering from that. Because what I want to ask for our viewers is that for you to give them a first-hand feel of what is it that these families need and what it's like to have a person with COVID-19 in your family, you know, given the pressures in the Gaza Strip today.
Well, Arash, the situation is extremely tough in Gaza. I mean, for example, if someone in your family has COVID, you need to have a proper medical care. You need fresh fruits and vegetables, vitamins, and all that costs a lot of money, and the people in Gaza are impoverished. Almost everyone in Gaza has been affected by COVID. I personally lost my mother last year to COVID-19, and almost every family or every neighborhood you go to, you know there's someone or who has died because of COVID or struggling because of COVID-19. Now you see, now it's the height of the winter season in Gaza, and you have the seasonal flu. So now when you see people sneezing or coughing, you won't even tell if it's COVID or it's just the regular flu.
All right. Thank you very much, Ashraf. Unfortunately, I did not know about your mother. I'm really sorry to hear that. Ashraf Shannon is our correspondent in the Gaza Strip, updating us on the situation that COVID has created in that part of the world. Thank you, Ashraf, and have a good day. Tensions over Ukraine are escalating, with Britain now warning that it will impose sanctions on Russia the moment it moves to invade its neighbor. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says it is vital for Russia to pull back its troops and choose diplomacy. He says any invasion would be a disaster. Johnson made the remarks during his visit to Ukraine, where he met with President Volodymyr Zelensky. The Ukrainian leader, for his part, said Kyiv would resist any incursion. The Western states, mainly the U.S., continue to beat the drums of war, saying Russia is preparing for military action against Ukraine, despite repeated denials by Moscow. Meantime, Russia is warning that the U.S. is seeking to drag it into a war.
The most important U.S. goal is to contain Russia. That's the thing. In this sense, Ukraine itself is just a tool to achieve this goal. This can be done in different ways. One of them is to draw us into some armed conflict.
Putin made the remark during a joint press conference with Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. The Russian leader said it's wrong to allow one country to increase its security at the expense of another. Putin also accused the U.S. and its allies of ignoring proposals Moscow delivered to Washington for security guarantees over NATO's eastward expansion. Moscow denies the allegations of seeking a military conflict, saying it has mobilized troops on its borders for defense purposes in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. At least a dozen historically black colleges and universities in the United States received threats of mass shootings and bomb attacks. The threats in cities from Baltimore to New Orleans has forced authorities to enforce campus lockdowns. This coincides with the first day of the U.S. Black History Month. One day, or on Monday I should say, a wave of similar threats forced the cancellation of classes at other schools. The White House says it takes these threats, quote, incredibly seriously, but that they still do not know what has motivated the threats. Last year, the U.S. intelligence services warned that racially motivated violent extremists, such as white supremacists, would seek to carry out mass casualty attacks in the country. Colin Campbell says the surge in threats against black Americans happens periodically in the country. He says this has its roots in some white Americans being dissatisfied with the advancements of black people.
We're in a political climate where we've seen the increase of white hegemons that want to control the future of America and its separation of races, where there would be some of an apartheid dynamic and giving deference of one race over another. We're also seeing a divided political country as well. And each generation, or every several years, there needs to be a major fight in order for black Americans to win equality and equity in the country. And now at a time when we're starting to see strides happening with more educated black Americans, black women are the most educated ethnic group in our country. When we're seeing these strides, we are also seeing a commensurate white lash that we have seen historically whenever black Americans increase their autonomy, increase their agency, and increase their socioeconomic mobility.
Washington is considering strengthening its military foothold on the African continent in an apparent bid to counter the growing influence of its strategic rivals Russia and China. That has raised concerns, considering America's track record in countries which house its military bases. With over 20 years of a military presence, the U.S. has not only failed to combat extremists and terrorists, it has also been involved in coups and overthrow of several governments, is a report.
Back in 2013, when AFRICOM was first established, only two African countries showed a willingness to host American bases. But now, even South Africa, which once led a campaign against American intervention on the continent, has hosted drills with the US. But that's a cause of concern, particularly considering the spike in coup attempts in West and East Africa, areas that host the largest concentration of US bases. At least seven coups over the past 13 years have reportedly involved troops trained under AFRICOM. Last week, a Pentagon report suggested a 70% annual increase in violent events linked to militant groups in the Sahel region. According to the data, last year, attacks across the region jumped from 1,180 to at least 2,005, the most dramatic hike on the continent. Those attacks have killed an estimated 4,800 people last year, accounting for some two-thirds of the total number of terror attack victims in Africa.
Well, I think the U.S. is very much afraid of Africa becoming, the countries of Africa working together and becoming a powerhouse that would be able to rival the United States and rival Western Europe. Because you have to think about it, Africa is a very, very big continent, which much bigger than the United States, with a lot more valuable resources in this modern age. So I think the United States is afraid.
The U.S. maintains its military presence in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism. But human rights groups say civilians have been caught in the crossfire and casualties from U.S. airstrikes are higher than have been reported.
Whoa. what you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
In the limelight.
The Islamic Revolution, which continues its inspirational awakening of the masses in the region and beyond, is an undeniable fact, as is evidenced by the positive developments in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Bahrain, Yemen, Afghanistan, Egypt, and Nigeria, to name a few countries. The astounding progress of Islamic Iran in science and technology, that is, medicine, stem cell therapy, the nuclear fuel cycle, aerospace, cyberspace, and artificial intelligence, and all other fields including profound influence on social, cultural, intellectual, political, and economic events outside the borders of Iran is proof of the far-sighted vision of Imam Khomeini. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kehan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading, A Revolution Was Burst of Light. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. February 1st starts the 43rd 10-day dawn in the history of Iran. It means it is now as many years since that memorable day when that sage of the age landed in Tehran to an unprecedented welcome seen anywhere in the world to guide people towards victory of the Islamic Revolution and establishment of the Islamic Republic. Millions of Iranians thronged Mehrabad Airport this day in 1979 to catch a glimpse of the return from almost 15 years of exile of the iconoclast at whose impending arrival the British installed and US-backed Shah had fled the country. No doubt, the enthusiastic masses in Iran sang in the streets via the radio and on the TV. The devil has fled at the approach of the angel. As the international media focused upon the charismatic personality of Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, God bless his soul, expecting some sort of sensation, especially when the apparatus of the Pahlavi regime was apparently intact and thundering threats, the unguarded imam and his millions of unarmed followers neither dug trenches nor went for weapon arsenals. Straightway, he drove to the Behesht-e-Zahra cemetery, which was blooming with more and more new graves every day as the regime continued its killing spree on the orders of its masters in the U.S. He chose the resting place of the seemingly dead to address the apparently alive all over the world where consciences had long frozen, if not become lifeless. Every word he spoke has been diligently recorded and is punctually heard and is screened every year and does not need to be repeated, including his emphasis on establishing the Islamic Republic system of government, his naming of the U.S. the Great Satan, and his promise of support to the oppressed people of Palestine. It is worth recalling that many of the self-acclaimed analysts and politicians around the world had chuckled at the words of the black turbaned and white-bearded religious scholar in his late 70s. They didn't give him much chance of survival, let alone success. They thought he was daydreaming. Most in the West were convinced that soon he would be taken care of by the Shah's U.S.-trained military or pushed into the sidelines by Western-educated and supposedly democratic-minded self-styled revolutionaries who were now pouring into Tehran from Paris, London, Bonn, New York, etc. to take over the country as one of those puppet republics. How utterly wrong they were! The analysts, the politicians, the experts, the Iran watchers, including of the so-called Third World, who saw developments in the world only through the stained glasses of either the capitalist in Washington or the communist in Moscow. No need to recount the spectacular developments of the past 43 years in Islamic Iran, which Imam Khomeini guided through the intensity of the devilish plots of the great Satan, including the 8-year war imposed through Saddam of the repressive Ba'ath minority regime of Baghdad. In retrospect, where are today's politicians, analysts, and experts in the West engrossed in the 4+1 talks in Vienna and the useless US sanctions? Like it or not, it is crystal clear that the Islamic Republic of Iran is the epitome of practical reality of a sovereign, independent country that has defeated global arrogance. Similarly, the Islamic Revolution, which continues its inspirational awakening of the masses in the region and beyond, is an undeniable fact, as is evident by the positive developments in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Bahrain, Yemen, Afghanistan, Egypt, and Nigeria, to name a few countries. The astounding progress of Islamic Iran in science and technology, that is medicine, stem cell therapy, the nuclear fuel cycle, aerospace, cyberspace, and artificial intelligence, and all other fields, including profound influence on social, cultural, intellectual, political, and economic events outside the borders of Iran, is proof of the far-sighted vision of Imam Khomeini. He predicted the end of communism, and it is no more. He foretold the collapse of capitalism, and it is on its last legs in the West. He prophesied the weeding out of the cancer's tumor called Israel, and its death throes are evident for all, despite the desperate bid of the U.S. to prolong its survival through the much-publicized open alliances with the equally precarious Arab regimes. Thus, in a last-ditch effort that speaks of sheer frustration and intellectual bankruptcy of the U.S., its devilish minions, after their utter failure in turning Syria and Iraq into Takfiristan through the most macabrely murderous terrorists, have resorted to state terrorism in Yemen in a hopeless bid to try to undermine the wave of awakening set in motion by the Islamic Revolution. Soon, this will also end in failure. And, as stressed by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who continues to ably guide Iran, inshallah, God willing, the current second 40-year phase of the Islamic Revolution will see more victories, watered by the sacred blood of the martyrs General Qasem Soleimani and Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, as well as those in Mesopotamia, Levant, the Arabian Peninsula, the Caucasus, Central Asia, the subcontinent, Africa, and other places, as the world eagerly awaits the promised new order of the global government of justice to be established by the savior of mankind, the awaited Imam Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance. Didn't the late Imam Khomeini say, "Our revolution was a burst of light"? Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello and welcome to a brand new series of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. I'm your host, Robert Carter. This week, we'll examine Israel's war against the Palestinian cause within the British education system and its attempts to impose an anti-BDS narrative into classrooms, specifically the use of a sophisticated behavioral change program targeting Muslim students. This sustained attack has entailed proxy groups editing textbooks, getting a lecturer fired, and more alarmingly, opened the doors for an anti-BDS group linked to Israeli intelligence to enter into UK classrooms. Solutions Not Sides, an initiative of the anti-boycott organisation One Voice, has spread widely across schools following the latest Palestinian uprising in May 2021. It was publicly recommended by former British Education and Defence Secretary and member of Conservative Friends of Israel, Gavin Williamson, in his letter to head teachers as a way of dealing with students' outpouring of solidarity with Palestine earlier this year. So let's delve in and investigate the truth behind the group's funding and their employees, which brings into question Solutions Not Sides' claims of neutrality, with Bianca Rahimi's eye-opening investigation coming up next.
Why is an Israeli intelligence-linked organization, which shared funders with the Friends of the Israeli Defense Force, illegal settler colonies in the West Bank, and the Conservative Party, teaching children about Palestine in British schools? The organization One Voice was founded in 2002 by Daniel Lebetsky, a billionaire businessman who sits on the advisory council of the Israel Policy Forum and is a current director of the Anti-Defamation League. Internal FBI documents indicated that the ADL was actually a proxy of the Israeli regime as far back as 1969. His organization, Peaceworks, aims to encourage trade between Palestinians, Egyptians, Jordanians, and Israelis in a bid to violate the international movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel until it complies with international law. One Voice is a continuation of that work, with Lubetsky claiming he was fighting BDS before people even knew that BDS existed, and asserting that One Voice and his funding vehicle Peaceworks are the best tools to undermine BDS. When studying One Voice's annual reports and the tax filings of its funders, we found that at least five of its financiers are invested in organizations that build illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. At least one of the funders financed the Conservative Party as well. For example, Ted Arison Family Foundation, which funds the Jerusalem Foundation, which builds illegal settlements in East Al-Quds, including Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. The Karen Foundation, which also funds the ADL, Friends of the IOF, Jewish National Fund, and PEF Israel Endowment Funds. The Crown Family Foundation, which funds American Friends of the IOF and settlement organizations, the Jerusalem Foundation, and the Jewish National Fund. Catwin Puswillow Charitable Trust, which also funds the Board of Deputies, the Quilliam Foundation, the Conservative Party, the Jerusalem Foundation, and the Anglo-Israel Association. Trevor Chin, well-known lobbyist from the Israel lobby group BICOM and a person who funded Labour Party leader Keir Starmer's leadership campaign. The board of One Voice also consists of a who's who of suspected war criminals, such as Danny Rothschild, a former deputy director of the Israeli military intelligence, commander of IOF units in occupied South Lebanon and the occupied West Bank. Ephraim Sneh, former deputy Israeli minister of military affairs and brigadier general in the IOF and members of Commanders for Israel Security.
As deputy minister, he was responsible for the assassination campaign against Palestinian figures, which was described by The Guardian as a policy of murder. Gideon Greinstein, founder of the Reut Institute, the Zionist security think tank and Israel lobby organization, which has described London as the hub of hubs of delegitimization for the Zionist project. Harriet Green, a director of BAE Systems, the British arms company which makes the HUD technology for target selections in Israel's F-16 fighter jets. BAE even has an Israeli subsidiary called Roka, which is a supplier for the IOF. Why is an organization which had three employees simultaneously working for the Israeli regime and at least 28 former IOF personnel and or Israeli intelligence among its workforce teaching about Palestine in British schools?
To discuss the issue of Israeli lobby activities in the British education system further, we have two guests in the studio with us today. Asa Winstanley is an investigative journalist who writes for the award-winning Palestinian news website, The Electronic Intifada. Asa has visited Palestine numerous times since 2004 and has written extensively on the workings of the Israel lobby here in the UK. And David Miller, an academic and former professor at Bristol University, who's also a leading British critic of Israel. David has co-authored a number of reports investigating the Israel lobby in both Britain and the EU. He's also a co-founder of the lobbying watchdog initiative Spinwatch. David was recently sacked by Bristol University after a sustained pressure campaign by pro-Israel groups. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on. I'm going to come straight to you, Asa. I'm relying on your expertise in this field for this analysis. From this investigation, at least three employees were working for the Israeli regime at the same time as One Voice. Now, perhaps you could just explain as simply as you can, what is Solutions Not Sides and the difference between them and One Voice, and what exactly are they up to in schools?
Well, Solutions Not Sides seems to be a kind of new way for One Voice to reinvent itself, essentially. One Voice is really a kind of normalization program. It started off more than a decade ago as a kind of normalization program between Palestinians and Israelis to try. The problem with normalization and why most Palestinians reject normalization with Israel is because it's trying to make an abnormal situation seem normal. So military occupation, military dictatorship in the West Bank, besieging the Gaza Strip, and to nonetheless carry on relations with Israelis as if it was all down to individual kind of links, and that's the only thing that really needs to change. But Palestinians rejected One Voice overwhelmingly, and it was really kind of not a success on that level. So instead, it seems to have reinvented itself in many ways and spreads to the West. So this is Solutions Not Sides started off as a project of One Voice, and it now seems to be kind of infiltrating British schools in a way that has minimal publicity, really. But they get into British schools through a kind of elite level, I suppose, in a way, through their relationships with the British government. So it's a really kind of insidious project in that sense.
Now, David, I'm going to come to you next, because your case is very, very interesting. It's not exactly the same as what we're dealing with here. Are there any kind of comparisons between what happened to you and these organizations which happen to be pushing this narrative, which you have done some work in challenging over the years and have ultimately got you in trouble with Bristol University?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is part of a wider strategy by the State of Israel to effectively capture whole areas of public life in this country and in other countries too. So they wanted to capture the Labour Party, and they targeted Jeremy Corbyn, and they got rid of Jeremy Corbyn, and they put in their own man, Keir Starmer, to head the Labour Party. So they've captured the Labour Party. And they're trying to do the same with the universities, and the attack on me is just part of that process. There are other similar issues at other universities, again led by the organisations which are at the forefront of this, which are in the case of the universities is the Union of Jewish Students, which is formerly a Zionist organisation. And these other organisations that we're talking about, Solutions Not Sides and One Voice, they are kind of the shock troops of Israel for the education system for schools. And so they're an attempt to present Israel as if as if this, the questions of Zionism are a question of balance and tolerance and seeing both sides. And that's, of course, the whole title of the organization, Solutions Not Sides. We don't want to take sides in this conflict. We want simply to think about how we get solutions. And part of the solution will be ordinary people coming together, putting aside their differences, and then we can all be nice to each other, and that will actually be a solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict as they would see it. Of course, it won't. What we see is in Palestine is the occupation by the Israelis, and that needs to end. That's the side one has to take. That is the only possible solution. So there is a side that one has to take in the Israel-Palestine question, and that's the side of a solution. And the solutions and sides are the same thing. They're not separate like Solutions Not Sides tries to suggest.
Now, David, one thing you said at the time when you were dealing with your dispute with the university, which is still ongoing today, you warned the fact that, you know, Arab students, Muslim students, their freedom of thought, their freedom of speech is under threat in the British education system. Solutions Not Sides claims to be battling against Islamophobia. What would you say to that?
Well, they present themselves as being against illiberalism. They present themselves as being liberal, but actually that's a sophisticated strategy to try and normalize Zionism, to try and pretend that Zionism is a legitimate philosophy and something which you might have different views about. Well, it's legitimate. No, on the contrary, Zionism, Islamophobia is fundamental to Zionism, and of course that's what they're doing in schools. They're trying to pressure kids in schools not to show solidarity with the Palestinians. We saw many examples of walkouts in May over Gaza and solidarity with the struggle of the Palestinians, and they want to undercut that. That's the whole purpose of this. One Voice, as you said, is an anti-BDS organization set up by people who describe themselves as being ardent Zionists, and that's what Solutions Not Sides is for. It's a kind of covert strategy to get into schools to push the Israeli narrative under the cover of being, oh, let's listen to everyone's voice. No, they're not listening to everyone's voice. They're pushing a Zionist a position in schools.
Asa, let's come back to you now. Obviously, you know, words that are coming to my mind is like whitewashing, gaslighting, certainly not impartiality, which is what these groups want to claim that they're doing. But what about the funding and the money that's coming from? I guess that's one clear indication of what these groups are really all about. Perhaps you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, well, I did some research on it recently, and the most recent financial statement for Solutions Not Sides available from the Charity Commission shows that the majority of their funding comes from British government grants, 70%. And their founder, whose name is Sharon Booth, I believe, says that was formerly an employee of the Ministry of Defence. But also, some 30% of their funding comes from One Voice, this pro-Israeli lobbying organization funded by a billionaire, presents itself as a grassroots organization, but it's actually a billionaire funded Israel lobby group. So what we see is the British state, I mean, it's in a way, it's kind of the Israelification of the British state. You know, it's an indication of that, I would say. That it's, as David has mentioned, it overwhelmingly targets, Solutions Not Sides overwhelmingly targets Muslim majority areas, schools in Muslim majority areas. And it's kind of really a sort of secondary part of the government's prevent strategy in a lot of ways, because it, although, I mean, ostensibly, you know, you could look at it and say, okay, they're just trying to find solutions, what's wrong with that, you know, and they claim to be a non-partisan organization, you know, so that's how they present themselves. But then actually, if you look closer at the documents, I mean, I've got some quotes here from it. It says that they're focused on, you know, solutions focused contribution. They want to provide humanizing encounters with Israeli and Palestinian speakers. That's on the surface. If you get into their declaration of principles document, however, they admit that they oppose, quote, advocacy and, quote, partisan solidarity. And elsewhere, they say they're against extremism. So this is all kind of coded language, really, in a way. When they say extremism, what they mean, really, is Muslims, Islam, and Palestine solidarity. Really, that's what they're trying to get at. It's kind of a smear campaign, in a way, because what they're trying to say is that solidarity, the Palestine solidarity movement, is akin to almost Al-Qaeda or some sort of terrorist organization, you know. That's kind of what they're hinting at. So, you know, this is a really kind of insidious thing. Even more on the surface, you know, teachers who maybe necessarily don't know much, aren't necessarily familiar with how Israeli propaganda typically portrays itself in this kind of quote-unquote balanced way.
They sort of prey on the ignorant in a way.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
Well, I do want to continue this discussion, but there is another element of the investigation that we've been doing that I want to introduce before we carry on. So, as strong believers in the right of reply, we decided to give Solutions Not Sides and One Voice a visit at their London office to discuss the findings of our investigation and give them a chance to air their views on what we have been alleging. But it didn't quite go as you'd expect, as Ahmed Caballo will bring us with this next report.
After our research into Solutions Not Sides, we felt apprehensive about the claims made by the organisation that it was a non-partisan actor in the Israel-Palestine dispute. So we decided to reach out for some answers. After discovering an address online, we gave it a try, but to no avail. We then visited the address listed, but after a long wait, it seemed like no one was coming in or out. It was all rather peculiar. So we just come out of the building that, according to the website, houses Solution Not Sides. Now, we spoke to someone that seems to work in the office. They claim that no one in the office is there. They asked us to call the number. I tried to call the number doesn't ring. It seems a bit suspicious to me that on a working day, no one's in the office from Solutions Not Sides. And also that the phone number that's registered online doesn't even work. It seems like they don't want to be contacted and don't want to be held accountable from members of the public or from journalists like myself that are just trying to find out information. We reached out to Solutions Not Sides via email and gave them ample time to respond to our questions relating to their apparent links to the Israeli regime. But so far, at the time of the recording, they have not responded.
Well, there you have it. We did our best to get to these guys to try and put our questions and views to them, but unfortunately we just couldn't find them. So Ace, I'm going to come back to you now. We did our best to track them down. If eyebrows aren't raised by our earlier VT and by what you've been saying, then they should be now. Just tell me, have you tried to reach out to any of these groups? Have they communicated with you in any way, shape or form?
Well, they do seem quite publicity shy.
I wonder why, and
this relates to what I was saying earlier about the fact that One Voice was really exposed a decade ago, like Palestinian civil society, Palestinian trade unions, you know, charities, Palestinian anti-occupation activists rejected the approach of Solutions Not Sides. You know, the BDS National Committee, the BNC, rejected One Voice and these kind of normalization activities. And so the fact that Solutions Not Sides as a project of One Voice in the United Kingdom in alliance with the British National Security State, it doesn't want to be its activities to be exposed or to put under any scrutiny in this way, and we see that, you know, the fact that it shares Solutions Not Sides shares personnel still with One Voice, the fact that it is partly funded by One Voice, it has, you know, the same personnel shares this office. Is it an office? Is it a shell organization? We're not quite sure. It seems that no one was there in the office, and the person who was on the door from that VT didn't seem they were there, but they're not there. It's a very strange situation. So, but clearly they have a presence in this country, and they have some sort of in with the British authorities. You know, for it to get for Sharon Booth, its founder, to be a former Ministry of Defence person. And to have most of its funding coming from the British National Security State, what's happening here?
It's very, very suspicious. Just from looking at that couple of BTs that we brought up, there's a lot of questions that you just can't get answers to, David. Mm. But what I want to ask you is, are there any other groups that should be named that are active in schools pushing these kind of narratives? If so, perhaps you could just briefly go through them.
Well, the letter which was referred to in the first report from Gavin Williamson, where he specifically named Solutions Not Sides as an organization that head teachers should engage with, also named two other organizations that they should engage with, and I can tell you about them. The two of them are the Community Security Trust and the Forum for the Discussion of Israel and Palestine, FORDIP, to give it its acronym. Now, the Community Security Trust, as many of your viewers will know, is an organization which says it's there to combat anti-Semitism in this country, but of course it's an organization which is strongly Zionist and which is unable to tell, or let me put it a different way, unwilling to tell the difference between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. So it follows the Israeli government's line on this, that anti-Zionists are just covert anti-Semites, and it uses that to attack the left and Muslims, and indeed Palestine solidarity work in this country relentlessly. And of course it's also engaged in monitoring and spying on the left and Muslim groups and Palestine solidarity movements. So that's one organization. The second one is this FORDIP organization. Now this is a slightly more complex organization. In a way it's like Solutions Not Sides and One Voice, because it's an organization which was set up by another organization, which is called the Council of Christians and Jews. Now that's a long-standing organization in this country. It's a pro-Israel lobby group. And it set up this FORDIP thing to do roughly the same kind of thing as One Voice and Solutions Not Sides do. And in fact, they've got some common personnel between them, people who've worked for one have gone to work for the other one. And the interesting thing about that is that the funding, of course, is quite similar. I saw the list in the report there of the various Zionist organizations which have funded One Voice or Solutions Not Sides, and some of those same organizations are funding either the Council of Christians and Jews or FORDIP. So there's a big crossover there. But there's another thing which is interesting, which is relates to Ace's point about the national security state. Both these organizations, FORDIP and the Council on Christians and Jews, are funded directly by the Home Office. And by the Ministry of Housing, etc., which is the counter extremism budget of the British state. This is the sort of anti terrorist budget. And so essentially, these are organisations which are working on behalf of the Home Office of British Intelligence with the funding that they get. So it's referred to as the Israelification of British security.
Correct me if I'm wrong, David, but what you're saying is that basically British taxpayers are paying for this policy, which is essentially pushing Israel's narrative onto schools, basically by force, Muslim-majority schools in many cases.
That's the case, yes. I mean, this is the most extraordinary thing, is that the British counter-terrorism policy prevent and the counter-extremism policy which they run effectively is pushing pro-Israel lines onto vulnerable kids in schools on behalf of a hostile foreign power, the Israeli state.
And this is obviously in face of the fact that certainly the Palestinian cause has overwhelming public support, but obviously within the Muslim community specifically, Muslims want to support Palestine, and that's an issue. I'm going to stay with you, David, because I'm speaking to you now with this final question, which I'll pose to both of you. Obviously, many people are concerned about what's going on here, and I dare say there may be alarm bells ringing within the community after watching this show. What should Muslim parents, any other type of parent in this country that's concerned about what's going on, do? What's your advice?
Well, they should complain and they should make it public. I mean, this is absolutely unacceptable, and there's no reason why these organizations should be accepted in schools. They should be banned from the schools, and the parents should make it clear to school management that they will not tolerate this. And it's already been the case in some schools, I understand, that some of these organizations have been removed from the school. That's what should happen. This is a foreign propaganda operation to oppress and corral the minds of young Muslim kids mainly, and it's just completely unacceptable.
Asa, we've got just under 2 minutes left, so I want to give this question to you as well. It sounds to me that basically children are being targeted by these groups in order to essentially brainwash them, dare I say the words, and that's quite concerning. They're targeting children. Is that right to say?
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with that. Like, I mean, Solutions Not Sides even talks about this quite openly, not in the same language, but I'd agree that's appropriate language. They say, I believe what they said, it's that they target pupils in the opinion-forming stages, something like that. So, you know, they do talk about this, and these are, and the fact that they largely, in large part, target Muslim children is incredibly concerning. So I think what has to be seen is we need to have solidarity. There needs to be solidarity with these communities, with Muslim communities especially, and the whole kind of Palestine solidarity movement, the trade union movement, needs to work together to oppose this kind of hostile foreign operation, as David put it. I mean, I would agree with that too. I mean, I think it's something that requires a kind of unity and a kind of we need to know what we're facing here.
And I suppose if parents came to you with stories of what's going on in schools, you could potentially cover it as a journalist in your newspaper. So there we go. There's some brilliant advice there. Thank you very much to both of you for bringing your expertise on the show. I think that was a brilliant analysis of this first topic, but there will be many more to come. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on the Palestine Declassified program. I've been Robert Carter, and it's bye for now.
In the limelight. A new report has warned the coronavirus vaccine divide is costing lives and supercharging inequalities worldwide. We're prepared for you an article written by staff writer of Al Jazeera website under the heading Oxfam warns as the poor die, suffer from COVID, rich get richer. A new Oxfam report titled Inequality Kills says the coronavirus pandemic has made the rich much richer, while the income of the rest of the world, nearly 99% of humanity, has declined.